This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're pleased to bring news of a stunning victory for the First Amendment in Washington, D.C.
The question of democratic rights is central, absolutely central, to any progress we're going to make in this country. We've had a big victory here. We've got the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund to thank for pulling this all together.
The U.S. House of Representatives just passed a resolution acknowledging the genocide of the Armenian people by the Ottoman Turks.
Well, it's about time. It's taken an entire century to do this. Let's hope that progress continues.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
In a stunning victory for free speech, the National Park Service was recently forced to do an about-face. It withdrew a proposal that would have placed burdensome restrictions on protests on the mall and other federal land in Washington, D.C. Citing feedback it had received from the public, more than 140,000 comments, the Park Service announced it was ending its efforts to rewrite the regulations governing speech and demonstrations on public lands under federal jurisdiction in the nation's capital. The proposed new regulations, made public in August of 2018 by then Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, would have imposed hefty and unprecedented fees on groups organizing protests on federal park lands in Washington. The Park Service has the responsibility and the legal obligation to protect First Amendment activity, and so it is good that officials dropped this plan. Joining us today is Mara Verheyden Hilliard, co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund in Washington, D.C. Over the years, Mara and the partnership have secured millions of dollars in settlements for police infractions of protesters' rights at mass assemblies. From 2000 and 2002, the IMF World Bank protests, to cases where law enforcement used false arrest tactics based on political affiliation. She also successfully challenged New York City's efforts to restrict mass assembly in Central Park.
Mara, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
I'm so glad to be with you.
Congratulations on this huge victory. I have to read a sentence from the Washington Post editorial. Quote, "The real credit goes to the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, which first raised the alarm about the changes, and the hundreds of organizations of all stripes that joined in opposing the plan during the comment period." Mara, that's some huge praise for you.
Well, it was really obviously a delight to see that editorial by the Washington Post on Sunday. You know, the thing about that editorial, in addition to, you know, certainly we appreciate the recognition, but it's also really talking about the core of what happened here, which was principled united front organizing. This could not have happened if we did not have so many groups and organizations and people all across the country who came together, progressive people who decided that they were going to fight back and join together in this uncompromising fight. That's what made the difference here.
Can you talk about just a few of the groups who came together over this? Was it national? Were they, civic-minded, grassroots?
Yes, and I think stepping back to talk about what the Trump administration attempted to do here is important because it then impacts all of the so many people across the United States, and that became the motivation for this incredible fight back. So the Trump administration in the middle of summer last year put out a 100-page rulemaking document in which they basically attempted to eviscerate protest in the nation's capital on federal land. And that would be all the locations that people think about when they think about iconic critical demonstrations, either that they've attended or historically. This is the Lincoln Memorial, the National Mall, the White House sidewalk, Lafayette Park, so many core places in Washington, D.C. where people come together and where history has been changed. And what this administration tried to do was put out rulemaking that would have changed the entire permitting system that's been forged over 50 years of constitutional rights litigation, where time and again, the National Park Service and the Department of Interior, which oversees this land and is supposed to be a neutral administrator of the space, has been forced again and again to comply with the Constitution and make these spaces available. And they wanted to impose bankrupting fees and costs for use of our public space that would have made it impossible for any grassroots group to protest. They wanted to change the rules that require the Park Service to act on permits in a timely fashion so they can't just sit on an application and wind down the clock. It's called a 24-hour rule. They wanted to basically do what we called an occupy ban, which would have made it unlawful to have any sustained presence more than 30 days, any vigil, any protest of any kind. And that doesn't happen that often in our history, but when someone comes and says, I'm not leaving until this issue is paid attention to, that's a really important capacity. They want to eliminate that. And they wanted to shut down the White House sidewalk, just close the White House sidewalk almost in entirety to protest. And you can picture the suffrage movement, the anti-war movement, the anti-lynching movement, so many people that have taken to that space, they just didn't want to have it anymore. So when we sounded the alarm and got the word out, grassroots groups in Washington, D.C. came together, as well as groups all over the country who come to Washington, D.C. So we're talking a united coalition of labor, of climate justice, of anti-war groups, peace groups, of women's rights organizations, LGBTQ, immigrant rights groups. Everybody came together and joined together in this fight.
How did you get the word out?
As soon as this document came out and we saw it, we broke down this 1,000-page document going through line by line, and we tried to break it into manageable explanation as to the key points. We did like a top 12 document of changes. We did more detailed legal analysis, and we made this material freely available to groups and organizations. We convened an initial coalition that then built into a larger coalition. It was basically there were coalitions of coalitions. And we put this material out, and we told people, just take this material, put your own names on it. You know, we didn't care about it in terms of, you know, some ego or interest in identity with the document. We just wanted the information out there. So people were using this material. They were adapting it for their own audiences. And we worked with groups to put in substantive comments into the administrative record, affidavits, very detailed challenges. The Partnership for Civil Justice Fund itself put in multiple detailed legal comments, because in this process, for the government to put out final rules, they have to contend with this administrative record. So there was 60 days within which to build this record, and everyone was working against this clock to build this administrative record. And it's important that there be more than just sort of petitions, more than, you know, people just doing a sign-on petition, because as a legal matter, the government can just sort of do a summary dismissal of that kind of, I oppose this because I oppose any restriction on my First Amendment rights. Those are important because it shows the numbers of people. But to really create an obstacle, we needed substantive comments. And they actually ended up with tens of thousands of substantive comments. And we believe that this is ultimately what stopped them. We had prepared a case. We were expecting to go into court and seek preliminary injunction to stop the rules from taking effect. We thought that they would be promulgating final rules at any moment. And they folded because they actually couldn't get over the hurdle of the legal record that had been built.
What do you mean by substantive comments?
So substantive comments in an administrative process in before a record closes, it's up open for public comment. And this is where people can submit their comments in, where they can say, I oppose these new rules, these are the reasons why. But very substantive ones are ones where people lay out a basis for their opposition. And that can be just in the form of a letter. It can be in affidavits, which we had affidavits put in the record, because this is the record that when we did go to court, this is the record that we would need to use. And we would be showing that the government had failed to address the particularities, because they have to make final rules, address the details of what's in this record in front of them. So there were sort of some groups were doing petitioning, and that was great because that, you know, lifted the number of comments. But the substantive comments meant that the Department of Interior and its solicitor's office, which I note is run by a Koch industry insider, would have to address these individual comments and explain why what they wanted to do wasn't a problem in the face of the legal challenges. And as we were coming down in that final, coming down to the wire in like the final 5 days before the record closed last fall, you know, there had only been about 1,200 comments in the record. And we were preparing to unleash this huge push. And as we did this with all these groups and coalition, we were thinking, you know, can we get past 5,000? Can we get past 10,000? Can we get past 30,000? And we're watching the numbers go up and up and up, because you can see the numbers as every day as the administrative record online visibly is getting submissions. And amazingly, it basically broke the needle. We went over 140,000 comments in opposition to this outrageous plan.
Why do you think that these proposed regulations resonated so strongly now?
I think that people are recognizing and experiencing what it means to come into the streets and stand shoulder to shoulder with other like-minded people and fight back against repression, against racism, against fascism, against misogyny. And many people who had never participated in political protest over the last couple of years have done so for the first time. And many others have participated, of course, in their lifetimes. And even others recognize, you know, from their family stories of, you know, how did you win the 8-hour day? I mean, they know what their grandparents and great-grandparents had to do to create a society that was, you know, incrementally everything that has changed for the better, and progressive change has come because the people have led. And the politicians follow. And at times when, you know, it looks just like an endless battle of people inside the Beltway sitting in Congress yelling at each other, people know that the change that they have to have is going to come from a mass movement of the people. You look at what's happening right now with people who are fighting for climate justice. The politicians aren't doing anything. It's the people that are going to make the difference. And if this administration can shut down protest in the nation's capital, you can imagine what would have happened all around the country. So that's why at the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, I mean, we dropped everything. And we turned to focus on this virtually 100%. It was a singular focus and a rapid response focus, because we knew we had to stop it. And it was incredible to see the response of so many people and groups everywhere across the United States.
Mara, the ostensible reason from the government for these rules was to help defray cost of security, trash removal, grass replacement. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this becomes the absurdity of that position. The Park Service's job is to manage neutrally our public lands. The lands belong to us. The lands belong to the people. And instead, they're looking at this portion of their existing job and their existing responsibility and basically disaggregating it and taking out these parts of it and somehow saying that First Amendment assembly is an extra cost. I mean, they could take out any number of things that they are obliged to do as part of their responsibility and suddenly claim that those are extra costs that they're going to charge back. I mean, if they want to charge the corporations that come to Washington, and they do to some degree, who, you know, take over vast public spaces because they're making movies here or TV shows, or the corporations that put on their 5Ks for this and that and their different runs. Okay, you can charge corporations for the use of public space. But when the people want to use public space, it is our space. We're entitled to use it. They cannot charge us for access to our public space. But they're trying to kind of change the impression of free speech in society, and this is part of a mass effort across the country, to suggest that it's not a fundamental right and also a fundamental need, that somehow it's an extra cost, that it's a burden on society, instead of the fact that it is fundamental and core to democracy. And I would note that this is part and parcel of a larger effort that we're seeing that's being spearheaded by the Coke industry to go all over the country and create these anti-protest laws and rules where they're basically buying off state legislators, working with the fossil fuels industry to criminalize at an extraordinary level nonviolent protest, to try and demonize nonviolent protesters, to license the police to engage in extreme brutality, to have extraordinary arrests, fines, penalties, threats of bankruptcy for organizations that work with nonviolent protest. So this is one element of a larger plan to shut down dissent and to shut down the capacity of people to fight in the United States.
Mara, are you aware of any jurisdictions where there have been successful changes to rules related to protesters?
Yes, there are laws that have been passed across the country and a lot of legislators. There are groups that are working in an organized coalition called the Protect Dissent Network, who are working together to fight back against these rules. So it's really an extraordinary threat right now that we're seeing. At the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, we are working and organizing to fight these rules all over the country. And we are looking at bringing litigation in order to similarly try and shut down these efforts where they are passing to try and bring challenges that are both as applied and facial challenges. This is going to require a coordinated, comprehensive, thoughtful approach because many of these rules are very similar from jurisdiction to jurisdiction because basically they're being written by ALEC, which many people know is a Koch industry-funded right-wing legislative enterprise. So this is a big fight, and this is really a fight that is going to determine the future of this country and the ability of people to take to the streets and fight for change and force change when we need it.
Mara, do you have an opinion on why this very successful organizing effort differed from other initiatives where the government and or corporations are trying to enact repressive laws and policies? In other words, was it the matter of timing, the confluence of current events, or was something else going on here?
I think this is really a demonstration of what can happen when you do have a strong, united, progressive, and uncompromising approach. And that was really crucial here. There were some entities, some civil liberties entities, that actually were taking a compromising position with the government. They were actually agreeing with the Trump administration on a couple positions that they were putting forward, including the ban on sustained vigils and protests, including an elimination of the 24-hour rule that basically would have put protest applications in limbo and made it impossible for groups to organize, because if you don't know you have a permit, you can't tell people, come, we're having a demonstration, and start building your demonstration. You just sit there waiting. So the fact that this larger coalition of organizations and groups decided that they were going to take an completely principled position, an uncompromising position, and fight all of these challenges, because it wasn't just, you know, an overt protest tax. They had actually written into the regulations more subtle ways that they could create intense and overwhelming costs on demonstrations. So sometimes with this administration, as we know, they come out with the most extreme, over-the-top plan, and people fight the outer edges of it and declare victory, but it's a victory that can be sometimes just a thin victory, whereas here it was crucial to not take that position, to fight the entire thing to its root and end it. And that's what we did here.
What would have happened, you think, had the government got away with this?
If the government had gotten away with this, it would have meant that the only people that could afford to mount protests in Washington, D.C. would be the extremely well-heeled, well-funded organizations, including, you know, right-wing organizations like the anti-abortion March for Life people and others that have huge funding. But for grassroots groups, the people with the least ability to have a voice, those who can't buy time in the mass media, those who don't buy off politicians, those who really have to fight with the mass number of people who can come into the streets and make an issue a dominant issue, they wouldn't have been able to organize. And the costs would have been extraordinary. The other elements to this that are structural elements, like the rule that I keep mentioning, you know, a prime example of the 24-hour rule of this not sitting on permits came about last year when the Nazis and the Klan wanted to have a celebration event basically in Lafayette Park on the anniversary of the murder of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville. And groups in Washington, D.C., decided that they were going to organize a counter-demonstration, but it had to happen quickly because the announcement of the right-wing rally had come quickly. If this rule hadn't been in place, they wouldn't have been able to do it. And what they were able to do was to quickly put in for an application, immediately begin organizing, and in the end, they had 15,000 people in front of the White House, and the Nazis had like a dozen. And if that hadn't happened, they wouldn't have been able to overwhelm them. The Nazis would have been able to take that space. They would have been able to declare victory. But instead, because of this 24-hour rule, because groups could immediately organize, and there were many groups who were saying, oh, don't come to the White House, go somewhere else, people needed to be able to say, we have a permit, it's lawful, it's a peaceful presence, you can come, we're going to have mass safe organizing, and that allowed that space to be taken by anti-racist, anti-fascist demonstrators. That's a clear example of what happens with the rule in place. If that rule was gone, Nazis would have had the day in front of the White House.
If listeners are joining us just now, we're speaking with Attorney Mara Verheyden Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund in Washington, D.C., about the successful rollback of repressive Parks Department protest regulations. Mara, a few minutes ago you mentioned environmental protests that are happening. Can you speak briefly about efforts to use the so-called necessity defense in court? There have been a couple of occasions, I think, where judges are letting that defense move forward. Your thoughts on what the continued future of environmental protest might look like in this country?
The protests over climate change and environmental justice are really at the core of what is driving the anti-protest laws around the United States. So we're seeing the fossil fuels industry attempting to shut down protest. A lot of this, if not most of this, is being funded by the Koch industries, who, as I mentioned earlier, have placed their guy in the solicitors, who's now the solicitor, which is the top lawyer at the Department of Interior, which was the entity behind the laws in the District of Columbia that we have now defeated. And around the country, they're trying to put in these anti-protest laws. So climate justice activists are taking to the streets. And in instances where they're being arrested also for nonviolent actions and nonviolent civil disobedience actions, and they're being prosecuted, there have been efforts and successful efforts in some jurisdictions to put forward what's called a necessity defense, which is the argument that you might have broken the law, but that you needed to break the law for a greater threat of harm that was going to befall people if you did not do so. And some judges have been allowing that to go forward. If you can get before a jury and a fact finder and say, okay, yes, maybe I took this action that stopped a pipeline from being able to operate, but I did so because had it operated, the danger and the damage would have been so extraordinary. The juries are willing to hear that. And if you can tell a jury, if you find that the danger and the threat so outweighed the action such that the action was necessary to prevent that danger, then you can exonerate the person. Juries are going to say, okay, yeah, like what this person did was good and it was right.
I just read that the oil pipeline that the protesters tried to stop in the Dakotas had a break, and they spilled 250,000 gallons of oil. And it seems to me that that's the kind of thing that people anticipated and would have required a necessity defense.
Right, and the folks who were water protectors who were trying to stop the KXL pipeline, and others who have been demonized, brutalized, criminalized, arrested, injured, they were trying to stop this from happening. I mean, the headlines were, I mean, ironic but not funny, that said, you know, Keystone Pipeline shut down after 383,000 gallons have poisoned the earth. Well, it should have been shut down before that happened. That is the point of a necessity action. This is what people are saying, that these pipelines are going to destroy the land, the water, the air, the communities that live there. They're destroying sacred lands upon that are, you know, the lands of indigenous people. And people are trying to stop it from happening. And now you can see what happens. We're seeing time and again the danger to humanity, in addition to just the use of fossil fuels and what that's done to our environment and to our climate.
Mara, that's a fitting note on which to end. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but how can listeners learn more about your work and the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund's work?
We would love for people to come join us in this work. You can come to justiceonline.org. That's justiceonline.org. Or our Twitter handle is at thepcjf, that's thepcjf, and sign up, and we will keep you updated about key fights that are happening and where you can join in. I mean, this shows that when we are working together, we can win, and we do win.
Congratulations to you and the partnership, Mara. Always a pleasure.
Terrific, Mara.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, keep causing trouble.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. Good trouble.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In a bipartisan rebuke to Turkey after its offensive into northeastern Syria, the U.S. House of Representatives recently approved two measures pushing back at its longtime NATO ally. The first measure was a symbolic resolution labeling the deaths of roughly 1.5 to 2 million Armenians from 1915 to 1923 in the Ottoman Empire, now modern-day Turkey, as genocide. It passed 405 to 11, with three members voting present. The second measure was a bipartisan bill that imposed sanctions on Turkish officials and prevents the sales of arms to Turkey for use in Syria. That passed overwhelmingly as well, 403 to 16. To this day, the Republic of Turkey enforces a gag rule against U.S. recognition of the Armenian genocide, despite overwhelming evidence documenting the crimes against humanity. Despite formal recognition of the genocide by the U.S. government in 1951 and then 1981, successive U.S. presidential administrations have supported the Turkish government's revisionism. Fearful of offending Turkey, they have opposed passage of congressional Armenian genocide resolutions and objected to the use of the word genocide to describe systematic destruction of the Armenian people. We're joined today by Aram Hamparian, Executive Director of the Armenian National Committee of America, or ANCA. ANCA is the largest and most influential Armenian-American grassroots political organization, working in coordination with a network of offices, chapters, and supporters throughout the U.S. and affiliated organizations around the world. The organization actively advances the concerns of the Armenian-American community on a broad range of issues. Aram, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Why is formal government recognition of the genocide so important, both to Armenians and also to Turkey?
I would say the recognition is important on a number of levels. As an American first, it's a foreign veto over what we can and can't say on a human rights issue, and that speaks to, you know, not just, you know, Turkish interference in U.S. policy, but, you know, Saudi interference, Chinese interference, other countries who think that D.C. is a, you know, a place where they can, you know, buy or bribe their way into influence. And I think it's a good message to send to other nations that they can't do that. American policy on human rights is set here in Washington by Americans. So that's an important thing. In terms of Armenia, the fact that Turkey is an overarmed, unrepentant perpetrator of genocide right on Armenia's border means that Armenia can't be safe. It's a daunting proposition to have your neighbor say that what they did in 1915, when they, you know, wiped out this huge number of Armenians and emptied the Armenian homeland, their basic proposition is that they were acting in self-defense. They would do it again, and that's certainly not good for Armenia's security. But in terms of Turkey, this would be part, I would suggest, of Turkey's progress, and it's a halting progress, and it's not always, you know, a steady progress, but in terms of Turkey's progress toward a more democratic, pluralist, tolerant society, I'm certain that dealing honestly, reckoning honestly with the Armenian genocide is going to be a key component to that. I mean, we've dealt imperfectly in America with the genocide of Native Americans, the vast injustice of slavery. We're at least able to speak openly about these things. We haven't maybe done all that we should, but at least we're there's a positive discussion on those issues, whereas that discussion in many ways is stunted in Turkey. So this resolution hopefully will foster more discussion, more open dialogue on the subject.
Now, did it lessen this recent victory vote in any way that it was to send a political message to Turkey's leaders with current U.S. dissatisfaction?
Well, I would say first, just as a generic statement, that waiting for Washington to act in an apolitical manner is a long-term proposition. D.C. acts in a political manner because it's a political town. People have their political priorities, and other issues, including very moral issues, are advanced in a political context. That's just the nature of Washington. If we were to wait for the right people to do the right thing at the right time, you know, for the right reasons, that might be a very, very long wait. But that doesn't mean that there aren't. Even the politics of this are relevant and very helpful. So today we're in a situation where Turkey is poised to commit new atrocities, this time in northern Syria, against our Kurdish allies, against at-risk Yazidis and Christians. It's really important to send a message that we're watching and that we will hold Turkey accountable for crimes of the past and crimes of the present. The idea is this. In America, that is willing to basically shut up at Turkey's request about the Armenian genocide is also a country that would remain silent regarding new atrocities. So we think it's actually a very, very timely message, actually very constructive, that, and the politics of it are actually, I think, very healthy in that we should send a message that the U.S. will not turn a blind eye to new atrocities in Syria.
Representative Omar's present vote has drawn some criticism.
She's probably the most progressive representative in the Congress, and on this one, she fell down. What was your response when you learned that?
Well, let me first say that our greatest concern is for the 11 who voted no, and those were all Republicans. So we were very upset about that, but we are going to engage with each of those 11 no votes. There were three members who voted present, which is like an abstention of sorts, one Republican from Arizona and two Democrats. Congresswoman Omar was one of the two Democrats that voted present, which was troubling, but what really troubled us was her statement that she issued, in which she said that issues like this should only move forward on the basis of academic consensus, and that is that's like a red line for us, because there is academic consensus. The International Association of Genocide Scholars has for decades unanimously voted on this issue. So it was sort of that drift into denial that troubled us more than anything else. Let me say this, that Congresswoman Bernice Johnson engaged in outright denial but didn't get nearly the same attention. I'm not exactly sure why. And again, we're trying to engage with the Congresswoman. She has expressed interest in meeting with our community in Minnesota. We're confident that if we can sit down, have a decent discussion, we could probably find some common ground on this issue.
What was Turkey's response to the resolution?
In the days leading up to the vote, the Turkish ambassador here, Serdar Kilic, wrote a letter to members of Congress in which he described the resolution as a baseless claim. So they're not trying to split the difference. They're not trying to find common ground. They're just saying this is a lie, you know, from whole cloth, an entire fabrication. The president of Turkey, Erdogan, you know, followed the vote in that same spirit, saying this was an absolute travesty, that, in fact, throughout the long history of Turkey and the Ottoman Empire, there's not a single example of a civilian massacre. So it was just, you know, to sort of double down on denial. The question mark for us now is, will or will not President Erdogan accept President Trump's invitation to visit the White House next week? We think that the invitation should be canceled, and we think it's wrong for America to reward President Erdogan with a White House photo op next week.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
Outrageous.
Yeah, I won't be surprised if the guy gets over here. In what ways has Turkey sought to prevent acknowledgement of the genocide?
Oh my God, in every way. This is really a fascinating thing. We study this really closely, and if you look at the lobbying dollars that Turkey spends and the diplomatic bandwidth that they've devoted to the overall universe of U.S.-Turkey relations for 30 years, some very large percentage, in some years a plurality, and some years a majority of the bandwidth has been devoted to this particular issue. And you might wonder why. Like, why would the government of Turkey today care so much about what America says about an atrocity of a century ago? And everyone, obviously, we've heard many interpretations. My best guess is that they understand that that absent U.S. complicity, that in the light of U.S. recognition of this crime, they would find their own position less sustainable. And it would be something like the South African government lobbying Washington in their final years, recognizing that once the U.S. broke with them, they would no longer be able to sustain their policy. I think that's probably the thinking in Ankara, because they do devote a lot of energy, a lot of lobbying dollars. They've hired an ungodly number of former legislators, many of whom have been or are now convicted felons, like Dennis Hastert and General Flynn. I mean, they spend a lot of money, a lot of their influence in this town on this issue.
What is Turkey's version, for our listeners who may not know, of the deaths of more than 2 million Armenians in the early part of the 20th century? They don't deny that the deaths occurred, do they?
It's been an evolution over the years, and with the caveat being that Erdogan is a bit of a throwback. So it started out with, in the 20s and 30s, as nothing happened. And then it became, well, something happened. And then it became, well, many people died, but people died on both sides. And then it evolved into, well, whatever happened to the Armenians, it was their own doing. They were troublemakers. They, you know, were they were the sin, apparently, of wanting a free nation, an independent nation, was apparently too much for the Turkish leadership to bear, and they had to, you know, wipe out this threat to their existence. So it's something like today, that Armenians were troublemakers and they had it coming, and we did what we needed to do, and the doctrine is something like, we would do it again, which is like chilling when Armenians hear that stuff. But it's something like, it was a difficult time, and the Armenians were a threat, and we dealt with them.
We're speaking with Aram Hamperian, who's the executive director of the Armenian National Committee of America, ANCA. Aram, if I might ask you a more personal question.
Sure.
What happened to your family back then? How did you come to grips with that whole story?
Yeah, I mean, well, all four of my grandparents were survivors, arrived in the U.S. as relatively young people in their early 20s. One side of the family is from what's called Diyarbakir now, which is a Kurdish-populated area in central Turkey. The other is from Sepahsitar, which is called Sivas today. And they were on the one side they were leather workers, on the other side they were shepherds, and they made their way to the U.S., and I had the chance to know a couple of my grandparents and grew up hearing the stories of their experience, and also in church growing up. I mean, I sat on the knee of many a genocide survivor and heard their stories, and it hurt them, I think, because they came to America and found a safe haven here and loved America, but always felt that it always hurt in a way that's hard to explain, that the country that helped them build new lives also couldn't find the courage to speak honestly about their history. And I'm hopeful that we're putting an end to that chapter, that there won't be a new generation of Armenians or Greeks or Assyrians or Chaldeans who will grow up in America with that shadow over their experience.
In 2014, the European Court of Human Rights ruled that it was not a crime to deny mass killings of Armenians by Ottoman Turkey, to not deny that it was a genocide. Human rights lawyer Amal Clooney was part of a team representing Armenia in a case in which a Turkish politician was convicted by Switzerland for denying the genocide ever took place. What is the danger of this ruling?
Okay, it's a very different concept than we engage with here in the U.S. In the U.S., the concept of a prohibition on a particular type of speech is, we just generally don't do that. That's just not part of our political culture. But in Europe, in light of the Holocaust especially, and especially the German experience and German history of committing the Holocaust, there's a different political culture, which is that certain types of denial are outlawed, and that it's illegal to deny the Holocaust or to lionize the Nazis in Germany in ways that it's not illegal here. And so that's also been adopted by a number of other countries, and the Turkish government has challenged it. But the burden of proof is, like, extremely different. Instead of, in the U.S., the question is, you know, did the genocide occur, and should we condemn it? That's the question. Over there, it's should people be punished, you know, by law, under the judicial system, for their denial of the Armenian genocide. So that what's known as the Perinçek case was an example in which I understand the ruling as something like, yes, the Armenian genocide is not in dispute, but we're not going to sanction this person for his speech on this particular topic in this particular way. So I think it was a narrowly argued case based on the criminalization of genocide denial. Within the context of European sort of jurisprudence, it makes sense. It wouldn't make sense here. So a lot of it's a different approach.
I wanted to switch the topic for a moment, please. The Armenian community is an ancient Christian community, and the Muslim community came hundreds of years after the Armenians had settled there and adopted Christianity. Can you talk about that, please?
Sure. I'll speak a bit about my own experience, which is that my family came from what's the Armenian Highland. They were pushed south into the Syrian desert, and then from Syria to Lebanon, from Lebanon eventually to New York. But in Syria, Armenians, my family, along with hundreds of thousands of others, were welcomed by Arabs and Muslims. They were given safe haven, food, shelter. So the Armenian experience in the wake of the genocide, or as survivors of the genocide, makes us extremely grateful for the compassion that was shown to us by people of Muslim faith. Another corollary to that, and this kind of came up in the context in the media around Congresswoman Omar's statement, she chose to vote present, but Congressman Andre Carson, who's a Muslim American, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib is a Muslim American, she voted yes, and Keith Ellison before that was a strong supporter when he was in the House. So I would say this, the Armenian genocide was a political act committed for political reasons. The fact that people of different faiths were on different sides, let's say, of that, I think sometimes gets overplayed. I think it was ultimately a political decision by the leaders of the Ottoman and Young Turkish governments to eliminate a minority in their midst. And they may have used religion to fan the flames, but I think ultimately it was a political act.
Adam, you were on the show back in 2014 after attacks on the ancient Armenian settlement of Kassab in northwest Syria by forces opposed to the Syrian government crossing the border from Turkey. The cross-border attacks included church desecrations, they forced immediate civilian evacuation. We never followed up on that. What was the result?
Okay, well, it was very frustrating. We were convinced and are convinced until this very day, and I think there's a general consensus in Washington today, that the Turkish government either facilitated that attack or turned a blind eye to that attack. They guard that border extremely well. They monitor that border extremely well. The the people who attacked, the forces that attacked the Armenian village of Kesab, crossed from Turkey, which is right at the border, right? Kesab's right at the border, and then, you know, drove out the residents of the village and then desecrated the churches and burned down houses. And at the time, there was great defensiveness on the part of the U.S. State Department. You know, they made the argument that, well, no, Turkey didn't know anything about it. We're convinced that this was just a rogue action. If you go to the State Department today, they, you know, left and right readily admit that, that Turkey was behind that. But at the time, they were, like, it was, you know, we got strong pushback that we would even dare to suggest that a NATO ally could do that. And now it's like common knowledge. It's very frustrating.
We have a few minutes remaining. To give listeners a better idea of what life in Armenia is like, how is the country doing now?
Awesome. We just had a major transition of government, a pro-democracy, anti-corruption government took over through a peaceful political transition that got a lot of attention. Armenia was the Economist Country of the Year for its like progress on democracy. The economy is doing well. Tourism is thriving. It's a great place to visit, a great place for kids. There's a lot of ecotourism. For folks who like to visit, you know, religious sites and ancient churches, there's no shortage. Armenia has hundreds and hundreds of churches to visit. So it's like a great, great place. And I go every year with my kids, and it's always a lot of fun.
Do you speak the language?
Sure do. And so do my kids, fourth generation in America.
Parev.
Parev. I teach Sunday school down here. Every Sunday I have a... six classes of third through eighth graders, and we teach them Armenian history, culture, and dancing, music, and it's a great part of our life.
An aside question: Kim Kardashian has been more vocal in calling for recognition of the genocide. She tweeted to, I don't know, tens of thousands of her followers. Do you think that helped?
Oh my God, yeah. Well, in just the last month or so, she tweeted. She's got 62 million Twitter followers, and she tweeted about. Possibly producing some of her clothing line in Armenia.
No.
Which would be great. We went back and forth. On that. And then she tweeted on the morning of the House vote, sharing our action alert on this issue, which really helped push us.
Fabulous.
You know, yeah, she's been a great ally, very
amazing.
Powerful ally.
Who would have predicted that?
And then when she becomes a full-fledged attorney, who knows what she can do?
Yeah, and she baptized her kids in Armenia recently. So
no.
Yeah, yeah, and she took an Armenian name. She was baptized herself, and she took an Armenian name, which is Herine, which is the Armenian version of the Greek Helen.
Oh,
which I think is.
I want to take that name.
That's
nice.
My mother's name.
Oh,
is that right?
Yes.
Amazing.
Aram, talk about ANCA and what they're doing now.
Sure. Well, we're going to work now on the Senate side to get a similar resolution passed by the Senate. We're having a little trouble with Senator McConnell. And the president, who remained silent up until yesterday, just yesterday had an unnamed State Department official criticize the Armenian Genocide Resolution, which we're very troubled by. But we're also pushing for a durable peace in Nagorno-Karabakh, which is a conflict in the region with Azerbaijan, and, of course, trying to boost up U.S.-Armenia relations and see more aid and more trade and more U.S. support for Armenia's progress.
As we wind up this interview, do you have any final thoughts that we should share with our listeners?
No, just that Armenia is an ancient country, has been dealt with this difficult history, but has been reborn, and we're a resilient bunch, and we're gonna keep on fighting, make sure that we. Have our place at the table of nations. We can learn from the world and contribute to the world, and and survive and thrive, I guess, is what we're all about.
How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Our website's great, anca.org, or just follow us on Twitter or Facebook. There's always lots of robust debate, pro and con on every issue. Armenians are never at a shortage for opinions, so it's really a fun place to engage.
Will do. Aram, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. You take it easy.
Law & Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN
107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW, 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP, 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC, 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT, 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD, 90.7 FM, Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF-FM, 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM, 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI, 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR, 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS, 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio, 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI, 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ, 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU, 90.7 FM.
WGCX, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Green and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Green and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR, 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen, WINO, 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York, WEFT, 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona, Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS, 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO, 90.7 FM Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM Corvallis, 91.9 FM Hood River. WSCA, 106.1 FM Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD, 88.3 FM Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA, 106.5 FM Olympia, Washington. WRIR, 97.3 Richmond, Virginia. KMEC, 105.1 FM Ukiah, California. KSVU, 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI, 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ, 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI, 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our Streaming Planet podcast. WPFW, 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT, 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG, 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL, 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP, 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD, 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP, 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRNLP, 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC, 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYR, LP, 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Workforce Rising online. KBFG, 107.3, Seattle, Washington, and KKRN, 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
And we'd like to extend a special thanks to KNSG, 89.1 FM in San Diego, as well as KGHI, 99.1 FM in Westport, Washington.
WMNB LP, 107.1 FM, North Adams, Massachusetts.
KODX LP, 96.9 FM, Seattle, Washington.
KKRN, 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
KBFG, 107.3 FM, Seattle, Washington.
WEJPLP, 107.1 FM, Wheeling, West Virginia.
That's on Mondays at 7 a.m. and Friday at 7 p.m. And finally, the Progressive Radio Network on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org, our producer Jeff Brady, so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.